Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the recent U.S. Security Cooperation with Nigeria. I'm joined by a returning guest and a friend, James Barnett, a PhD candidate at Oxford University, where he studies the political roots of insecurity in Nigeria since the country's return to democracy or civilian rule in 1999. James is also, among other things, a fellow with us and a non-resident fellow at several centers and institutes, including Center on Armed Groups in Geneva and the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. James, it's a pleasure to have you join me again today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much, Michael. It's always a pleasure to be on this podcast. And this one I feel like is particularly topical and timely. So really happy to be here.
Yes, I do agree with you. So we've been let's start off from 2025. So we woke up to, it was a Christmas morning. There was a bomb strike in Sokoto. The U.S. Bomb strike in Sokoto, and I think that is where this recent was kind of like announced. That's kind of like the announcement of the U.S. When I say announced in this spectacular way, the recent one. So what is behind this current U.S.-Nigeria military cooperation?
Yeah, so I mean, as you state, right, the probably for a lot of Americans, a lot of folks internationally, the U.S. airstrikes in northwestern Nigeria and Sokoto State on Christmas Day last year were probably kind of the introduction, if you will, that the U.S. military is now conducting operations in Nigeria, but of course, for most Nigerians, we're of course aware that for several months prior to that, there had been kind of discussions between the U.S. and Nigerian government, prompted by the Trump administration designating Nigeria a country of particular concern over religious freedom violation concerns at Halloween or something, very end of October last year. But then, that in and of itself does not by any means entail kind of a military component. It's essentially just kind of a designation that, opens up a whole range of policy options for the U.S. So it was, and in fact, the Trump administration had designated Nigeria, a country of particular concern during the first Trump administration. So what changed was the U.S. President essentially, warning or threatening that the U.S. would go in, quote, guns a-blazing, to solve Nigeria's problems about, violence against Christians if the Nigerian government didn't tackle it and didn't take it seriously. And of course, that remark, really put the Nigerian government on alert. Nigerians were very polarized over that remark, some very in favor, some very against. But what wasn't clear at that stage was, okay, well, what does that look like, right? The Trump administration has now taken, a strong interest in Nigeria, a stronger one, it seems, than in their first term. They have their particular kind of framing around the country's insecurity, that the country's fundamental problem is kind of Islamist violence against Christians, persecution of Christians. That's a whole other debate. The reality is, more complex, although there is persecution of Christians and religious freedom issues in the country. But the, you know, what the Trump administration was actually going to do at that point was very unclear. Is this going to be a unilateral intervention in which the, you know, the U.S. kind of comes in and you know, attacks militant groups in Nigeria that it deems are killing Christians without the invitation or support of the Nigerian government? Is this going to be, some Nigerians even, I think quite, you know, feverishly and unrealistically were thinking, oh, the U.S. is going to do regime change in Nigeria. I think the Nigerian government kind of very quickly realized that it would need to kind of try to come to the Trump administration as kind of a good faith negotiating partner to try to steer, you know, the administration's interest in Nigeria in a direction that it thought was more kind of, you know, politically sustainable from its perspective. And so for them, that was essentially, you know, getting the U.S. to cooperate to kind of become more involved in the counterterrorism operations against particularly ISWAP and Boko Haram or JAS in northeastern Nigeria. Again, you know, the context to all this is that, you know, the Nigerians did not proactively invite or ask for this kind of U.S. military intervention, but they did it essentially as a way of trying to kind of make the most of what could have otherwise been a very risky situation for them. And I think, you know, to move it to the discussion of Al-Manaki, the senior ISWAP commander who was killed last weekend, the, you know, what kind of was different this time as opposed to the strikes in Christmas was that the U.S. airstrikes on over Christmas really had the image or the impression of being a unilateral U.S. military operation. You know, the Nigerian government kind of insists that they participated, they helped choose the target and all of that stuff. I think, you know, there was, you know, a degree of that definitely, but it still kind of has that impression that the U.S. kind of pushed that down the Nigerians' throat and said, we're going to launch airstrikes because, you know, this will look good. I mean, the symbolism of it on Christmas Day, right? Trump even admitted that he delayed the strike so they would happen on Christmas. It plays very well to his political base. And I think that one, you know, those strikes, you know, in addition to their kind of, you know, very legitimate questions about their tactical or operational impact on these armed groups, you know, I think they created a real narrative problem, a real political problem for the Nigerian government. And so that's where kind of we've seen things maybe shift a bit with this latest operation, although I think there are still a lot of challenges remaining there.
There's a lot of things here, but let's take it one after the other. So you talked about, and rightly so, in your assessment, the polarization. Nigeria is kind of like divided roughly equally between Christians and Muslims. And the framing, like you said, the problem with the framing of this conflict in terms of like the Nigerian, in terms of Christian persecution and Muslims. And I was one of those people that also came out against such framing, you know, looking at, so having studied this conflict and look at, yes, there are Christians that are targeted, but not in the way that it was framed. So I guess the question to begin with is, when we look at Trump's administration in particular, it's quite interesting that it's one that has canvassed for America First. And you know, just it's very close. But what we've seen, again, is also one that is transactional in nature. So where you could see conflicts in other places like Sudan, like places you think would demand, you know, more immediate attention. And so people rightly ask, why? Why Nigeria? And do we really care about the Christians that much? Is this a cover for much bigger stuff? So are these merely conspiracies, or is there truth in this kind of like pushback against America's counterterrorism response or attack in Nigeria?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to note two things. One is that, you know, I think the current policy we're seeing now, which I'm happy, you know, I'd like to discuss more later, I think is actually in many ways quite different from even what some of the advocates of a U.S. intervention or a U.S. role to protect Nigerian Christians would have actually kind of, you know, preferred. I think there's a bit of an interesting disconnect there that kind of is rooted in some of the pragmatism and the military realities within Nigeria. But in terms of kind of what do advocates, or what does, you know, the Trump administration want with Nigeria? You know, I don't read tea leaves, if that's the expression, right? I can't really surmise. I think, you know, that a lot of people suspect that, again, Trump is very transactional, that maybe, you know, other aspects of the bilateral relationship with Nigeria will come into this. Maybe he's interested in minerals, oil, stuff like that. You know, it's possible we could see that later. We've not seen that articulated yet. I also think an important thing to remember is that despite, you know, how much Trump feels like a major presence in Nigerian politics today to Nigerians for good reason, Nigeria is not a major focus of Trump personally, it seems, or the Trump administration. That's very much my view. You know, he's been much more focused this year on Venezuela and now Iran and Cuba and all that stuff. You know, the summit with China, with Xi Jinping. So I don't know so much about, you know, Trump personally, but what I can say is that there is a kind of strong constituency in the U.S. that is has been raising, you know, concern about the suffering of Christians in Nigeria for a long time, you know, since before Trump was in office in 2017. And there are several reasons for that. You know, the most important and fundamental of which we have to acknowledge is that a lot of Christians are dying in Nigeria. And, you know, particularly in states in the Middle Belt or the North Central region, you know, however one calls it, you know, the violence, I mean, going back to the 1980s, there has been communal violence between Muslims and Christians. We could have a separate conversation. I think that the nature of the violence has actually changed a good bit. I would argue that a lot of the violence from, you know, 1987 up to the late 2000s was truly kind of, in many ways, religious violence, you know, debates over the kind of the arguments around Sharia law, stuff like that. I think a lot of what we're seeing in the Middle Belt now, my understanding of it, my framing of it is different. I think that, you know, especially these issues with Fulani herders, it's more about ethnic, you know, ethnic identity, grievances, criminal opportunism, all that stuff. But the, you know, the point is that a lot of Christians are dying in that part of Nigeria. There are also, you know, strong kind of historical, you know, even kind of religious connections between American missionaries and, you know, especially some of the minority communities in the Middle Belt. If you go to a place like Jos today in Plateau State or Makurdi, you know, you see there have been missionaries there for generations in some cases, American missionaries. So there is, you know, they're not kind of a major constituency, maybe population-wise, but they're a vocal one in the U.S. There are people who care about this issue. And, you know, I think there's kind of, again, a broader discussion to be had about U.S.-Africa policy. But I think that generally, because Africa is not at the same level of kind of strategic importance or interest to the United States, kind of foreign policy and national security community, as some other regions, you know, in some ways, kind of those constituencies, those pressure groups, whatever you want to call them, can kind of move the needle, you know, quite a bit. We saw this, you know, if you go back to even the kind of U.S. support for South Sudan, you know, from the especially the 1990s onwards, you know, and that ended up really shifting U.S. policy towards the region, even though it wasn't kind of a major issue for most American voters, but there was a prominent constituency there. So I think that, you know, that kind of explains a bit of the domestic politics a bit. But of course, where we've gone from last November to the present day, has also kind of evolved quite a bit.
Let's come back. We'll come back to the strategic interest and political world, but let's go back to the counterterrorism aspect of it. So the attack on Christmas Day was quite vague in terms of people also question the veracity of that attack, the authenticity of that attack. If it happened, they also question the target of that attack and the place of the attack. But then again, there seems to be that kind of also suspicion with this recent attack and assassination of the ISIS number two. A lot of people are saying, oh, this guy has been killed. It's been announced before that this guy has been killed in the past. And people tend to say that what is going on. So what do we say about the authenticity of this attack? There seems to be
I mean, I this one seems to be the real deal. I mean, even the Christmas strikes, I think, were, you know, the U.S. kind of announcement that they were targeting Islamic State fighters in Sokoto State, I think is true. I think they were targeting the Islamic State Sahel province. My assessment, I've written quite a bit about this, is that, you know, the group known as La Kurawa, at least operating in parts of Sokoto State, is kind of, that's a cover label, if you will, or an exonym for the Islamic State Sahel province. So, you know, I think they were targeting the Islamic State in the Sokoto, in the Christmas Day attack. From what I've, you know, discerned, I don't have, you know, full verification on this or anything, but I don't think that attack was very successful, you know, even in terms of just who it struck and how many fighters it killed. In terms of this latest attack, though, I mean, Abu Bakr al-Manoki was or also known as Abu Bilal al-Manoki, was a very senior ISWAP commander. He was an important one. There's disagreement among analysts about whether he was the head of the global director, or sorry, the general directorate of provinces, which is effectively kind of the number two within the Islamic State. So there's no, you know, the caliph of the Islamic State, the so-called caliph, doesn't have a mug that says number one and then his deputy is number two. They don't. Right. So they don't have official rankings like that, or numerical rankings. But the, you know, the head of the GDP, to use that acronym, is an incredibly important and influential office within the Islamic State, because, you know, these days the Islamic State is not really ISIS, the so-called caliphate in Iraq and Syria. It's this global autocratic organization spread out, you know, provinces around multiple continents. And the head of the GDP is responsible for coordinating strategy, logistics, resources, all that stuff between them. So Al-Manoki, I think we can be pretty confident that he was genuinely killed this time. You know, the U.S. has a better track record, frankly, than the Nigerian army when it comes to, you know, they're a bit more cautious about announcing this stuff. The Nigerian army has claimed that there, you know, that the incident in August 2024 in Kaduna, where they claimed to have killed him, that it was a different guy, different nom de guerre. I think there's a whole discussion to be had about the Nigerian military's strategic communications, you know, efforts and challenges. But, you know, it does seem like they got Manoki. And I think that whether one believes that he is the head of the global directorate of provinces, which is something that the U.S. has actually, I think, assessed for a little while. It's not something that Trump just, you know, made up after the strike. You know, it's even in United Nations reports from earlier this year that some countries believed he had assumed that role. So whether we think that he has that role, or what some other analysts suggest is that he was more of kind of a senior commander within ISWAP, who was also probably involved in kind of logistics and coordinations with the Islamic State Sahel province. You know, either way, he is a very significant, important commander. My own view is that, you know, I've heard from defectors that I've interviewed that he did have some sort of regional role, even if they were a bit vague. You know, when I started hearing reports about a year ago that Manoki had possibly been elevated to the head of global director of provinces, I was initially very skeptical, essentially because there's a more senior commander within ISWAP who has the longstanding ties to the Islamic State central network, and that's Habib Yusuf, Abu Musab al-Barnawi, the son of the Boko Haram founder Muhammad Yusuf. But then, and I'd also been hearing for a while some chatter, some rumors that al-Barnawi had died. And initially I didn't think that was very likely. And then kind of earlier this year, I started hearing some different information. And then a month or two ago, Ahmed Salkita at Human Angle wrote a very detailed report about al-Barnawi's death that you know, corresponded with a lot of what I'd heard. So I thought, okay, well, maybe there's some truth to this. Again, I don't know. You know, I don't know for certain. The Islamic State goes to great lengths to, you know, to cover up the identity of these senior people. And they don't always acknowledge the death of these senior commanders unless it's the caliph, the overall leader of the group. So I think all of us analysts are kind of, you know, we're all doing a bit of, you know, inference work and guesswork and stuff. I would say that the U.S. narrative that he was, you know, the number two, if we take that to mean head of the GDP, I think it's plausible, certainly not confirmed. I think even if he wasn't the head of the GDP, even if he was just the senior commander within ISWAP, involved in coordinating with other affiliates, that is still a significant position. And I think that you actually have more operational impact when you take out someone like that than you do when you just fire a bunch of tomahawks at a field in Sokoto State because there were some, you know, Islamic State militants in the general area. You know, that said, there are also, I think, limits to what these types of strikes can do, and happy to talk about all that. But
speaking of impact, I was going to ask that. That's what the next question I was going to ask you, the impact of taking him out. Because we've seen from Obama era, we saw where, you know, there was a policy, especially in the Obama era, of taking out senior commanders through drone attacks. They're taking, they took up Osama, they took all this stuff. But what do you think this? We're also seeing in recent times, we're seeing an escalated attack from ISWAP and from Boko Haram against military formations, military, you know, and they're quite being successful with this. So whilst we're seeing this, and do you think this is going to have an impact? You did mention, you said operational impact. Do you think this is going to de-escalate the rise of attacks that we're seeing from ISWAP and Boko Haram?
So I think that that's not it. I think that a killing like this can have an impact, and that, but that measuring attacks from the group afterwards is not necessarily the best metric to determine what that is, right? Because Mainoki's, you know, role, it seems, a lot of what he was doing was coordinating between ISWAP and this other affiliate, the Islamic State Sahel province, which has been expanding, as I've said, you know, even into Nigeria. And so ISWAP and the Islamic State Sahel province are, we know that they've been coordinating to some degree. They send, you know, individuals, fighters from one province to another sometimes. They engage in skills transfers, they share resources, they seem to share some, maybe some funding as well. All of that, you know, Nigeria, the US, you know, everyone has an interest in stymieing that to the extent possible. We don't want two Islamic State provinces coordinating closely together and moving closer to each other territorially, especially when one of them, like ISWAP, is already, you know, frankly, quite a strong, sophisticated insurgency, and IS Sahel province is also growing. So I think that, you know, taking out someone like that, I think it can. I mean, I don't know, I'm not privy to obviously all the details and stuff, but my sense is that he was a pretty significant commander in that effort. And so taking out someone like that is a way of disrupting that coordination. And essentially, you know, what that's doing is you're trying to contain the threat. You're trying to stop it from expanding. That is very different from kind of degrading the group or degrading the insurgency as a whole. And so it's it's still a very long ways away from victory, right? And I think that there, the empirical record, especially kind of from the war on terror, but also, you know, the war on drugs in Latin America and all these other places, is that, you know, leadership decapitation has kind of mixed results at best. Under certain circumstances, under certain conditions, it can be an effective way of, you know, kind of sustainably weakening an insurgency, but very often it's not. You know, very often these leaders are replaced, and it's, you know, so it can be a component of a successful, you know, counterinsurgency in theory, but it's rarely going to be sufficient as a strategy in and of itself. My fear is that with ISWAP, they've already gotten very sophisticated. They've already lost a number of commanders and been able to replace them. They've controlled a lot of territory now for, you know, ISWAP as an organization for a decade, and then, you know, more like 15 years if you include JAS before that under Abu Bakr Shekau, which is of course the group they split from. So, you know, they've raised children in their camps, you know, in their villages that they control. They've raised a generation that, you know, is going to continue fighting this insurgency unless conditions change, because this is all they've known. So it's certainly not a substitute for, you know, whatever it is that you know, is required to kind of more meaningfully contain and degrade the group. And I'm happy to talk a bit about what that might look like. But it is, you know, it's like, you also can't just let these guys go about doing their thing. You know, you do need to put pressure on the group. And I think that, you know, this is a pressure point that makes sense, because it is trying to contain that coordination between different insurgencies.
I've always been an advocate of a better approach to fighting. And, you know, I saw you laughing, we're going to talk about that. But I've also, in my writings, for groups like this, is justifiable to use some level of military response. So it's quite justifiable. But we must also look at how those responses also lead to more of the violence that we're trying to counter. So let's take it back to the 90s. So in some of the Boko Haram literature, you see where they say the surveillance of especially now the US. So we're going to go back to the US military agreement and cooperation. So this is what I want to talk about. We had it earlier on in the 90s where also the US was the one leading, because you did mention about, which I agree with you, the strategic communication of the Nigerian military is not all that credible. And you did talk about the almost kind of unilateral attack on Christmas Day. So we'll go back to the 90s. In the 90s, in some of the Bokram literature, we've seen that some of the writings suggest that the surveillance of the US, particularly the US, of people of interest during these times and collaborating with the Nigerian government is partly responsible for Boko Haram. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at this cooperation as well. Do you think in the long run this can have rather than give us, it could give a short term gain, like, you know, like what you just mentioned. But do you think in the long run, do you think it might present something that is not very positive in terms of how the insurgency transforms?
Yeah. I mean, so I guess 2 points there. First, regarding the historical stuff, I don't think that the U.S. played a direct role in the emergence of Boko Haram, other than, you know, the general U.S. foreign policy and how that interacted with the emerging kind of Salafi jihadi movement and Al Qaeda and stuff, and then the global war on terror was ideologically and, you know, ideationally, you could say, was very important to the early Boko Haram members. But I think, I mean, we should have another podcast episode about this now, because I'm writing a chapter on this for my dissertation. I think that I think we're seeing more evidence of this now coming out, and we're getting more of this from interviews with defectors. Human Angle even had a very good story about this a couple weeks ago, a really deep dive. Like, I think that there has always been a very radicalized element within Boko Haram that was going to require some sort of security response. Yes, ideally very targeted, you know, police, judicial, all that stuff. But, you know, they were planning to build an army. Muhammad Yusuf was planning to build an army from pretty early on, it seems. And so I think that there was always going to be a military dimension to this. I also think, as you and I both know, the military's response, or the state's response generally, particularly from Operation Flush onwards, you know, often exacerbated things more than it helped them, because I think it drove a lot of people into the arms of the insurgents by being very draconian. So sorry, I had to address that historical bit quickly. Regarding the U.S. role, I mean, so my, you know, military interventions, you know, or military support of this nature, whatever you want to call it, is never apolitical. And so you always have to weigh whatever tactical or operational benefits, you know, the kind of intervening, you know, the international partner, if you want to call it, is providing with the political risks there. And I can definitely envision ways in which, particularly not so much the Meineke raid itself, which I think, as I've said, I think that was actually a very successful operation, though I think there are some communications challenges around it. But I've been more curious about, after the Meineke raid, the, you know, AFRICOM announced several more airstrikes that, you know, from what we can tell, it's not clear that they were targeting major ISWAP figures. Some of the footage they've released, you know, it's kind of a handful of fighters and stuff. And then, you know, there's this kind of cognitive dissonance, where the Nigerian military is insisting that, oh, the U.S. military is not conducting operations, they're just providing intelligence support. And I made this point on Twitter the other day about that discrepancy, and some of the bots or people or some mixture of them, you know, we're killing terrorists is good, why are you complaining? And my view is, well, you know, political, it's like, of course, you know, yes, this is a war. The Nigerian military was already fighting Boko Haram and ISWAP. They were already killing a lot of these guys, right? We can talk about how well they were doing it, well, you know, whether it should be more or less, whether it should be more calibrated, or which ways it should be calibrated. But like, the U.S., you know, presence in and of itself is not a game changer insofar as, oh, now they're killing ISWAP fighters. I think a lot of Nigerians aren't aware that actually there's been a lot of bombing in the Northeast in recent years. And of course, it hasn't, you know, solved the conflict. It hasn't defeated the insurgency, because it's a very intractable insurgency. And there are also, you know, some shortcomings to the government's approach. But so, you know, the U.S., I'm a bit more concerned about is if the U.S. kind of moves into this posture where we've seen in like Somalia, or, you know, Libya at the height of the Islamic State kind of presence there, where, or, you know, even Iraq and Syria during the height of ISIS, where, you know, the insurgents have a really big territorial area and there's no real local government that's capable of fighting them on their own. And so the U.S. and other countries come in and do kind of sustained air campaigns and stuff like that. Or in Somalia, it's been kind of sporadic, but also very frequent, right? Launching dozens of airstrikes a year, kind of with only nominal cooperation in many instances with the actual host government. And the reason for that is because, you know, in Somalia, the Somali government doesn't control much of the country at all. Even in areas that are not controlled by al-Shabaab, they're controlled by these, you know, highly autonomous member states like Puntland, for example. You know, Nigeria is not Somalia. For all its many problems, and I've written a lot and talked a lot about how the country has, you know, lost sovereignty, de facto sovereignty in much of the rural areas, especially to various militants. But the Nigerian state has much more capacity than, you know, even if you look at like Mali or Burkina Faso. The Nigerian military has much more capacity and capability than, yeah, those of these neighboring Sahel states. And it already was fighting these insurgents, however we want to, you know, grade their performance. So I don't see, you know, things like these raids on, you know, on the high value targets, people like Mainuki. I think that's one thing we have to recognize, that, you know, in those areas, the U.S. really might have particularly intelligence that, you know, can be very valuable to the Nigerians. And so that sort of coordination can be really helpful. But I don't see the military logic in the U.S. just kind of continuously operating drones that are just going to fire at any suspected ISWAP guys they see whenever they want in the coming, you know, in the coming months or years or whatever. I mean, I think that's kind of the definition of mission creep. And, you know, in Somalia, you can make the case that, well, this, you know, the Somali government doesn't have an air force. They barely have an army. If it weren't for international support, al-Shabaab might still be in Mogadishu, right? They probably would be. That's, again, that's not the case in Nigeria. And so the military justification, I think, or the military logic is much less clear to me of that kind of sustained, you know, military pressure, military presence, kind of the, almost the mowing the grass approach. Whereas the political risks, I think, are very real. They're hypothetical because no one knows what the future holds, but they're not intangible, right? We've seen across the Sahel how, you know, frustrations with Western military presence, people have very high expectations, and then the frustrations when those expectations aren't met, concerns over neocolonialism, sovereigntism, all that stuff. And then you add in the fact that the political narrative that the Trump administration has embraced for justifying this intervention is one that, whatever one thinks of it, it is very polarizing within Nigeria, right? There was a ton of I mean, I saw it from colleagues, I saw it in WhatsApp chats, after the Sokoto strikes particularly. I mean, you know, right? Sokoto, the former seat of the Sokoto Caliphate. This, you know, a lot of, there were rumors going on that, you know, oh, the U.S. is at war with Nigerian Muslims. And you had clerics saying that. And I think it's down to luck and some, you know, good messaging on the part of some key Nigerian figures that we didn't see, you know, serious unrest after that. So, so this is all kind of a long way of saying that, like, you know, I think the Mainuki stuff was good. It's not going to solve the conflict, but if there is going to be a U.S.-Nigeria military partnership, you know, I'd like to see, you know, it look more like that than see what we have in Somalia, because we've not done the Somalia approach in a country like Nigeria, and I'm not sure how well it plays out. And I'm not sure, you know, even the reactions within the Nigerian military, again, there's a whole lot of history there, history that takes us to last autumn even.
I don't know if you've heard this, but I've heard this, and I've seen it through my research, interviewing also the military, Nigerian military. And you can also see it. I think that there's truth to it. You could see in the tens a relationship between the military and the U.S., particularly the U.S., and let's say the Western foreign partners' military, but the U.S. particularly. The Nigerian military is quite wary of the U.S., military assistance. And I've seen where, and I'm speaking to military generals, I'm speaking to people that are involved fighting Boko Haram, and they're quite suspicious. They don't speak highly of that cooperation. And you can see it in the kind of the miscommunication or tense communication. So that is what I'm quite looking at. Again, Tengo, you mentioned the Sahel. And we've seen in the Sahel, look at France, and then look at the the American troops on American bases in Niger. America was asked to leave from Chad, from all of these places. And there is rumor, there's always been rumor that a Nigerian was approached to have a military base in Nigeria. And stuff like that. So I guess the question is this. Can we I'm trying to lean towards what you were saying early on, because you were kind of like alluding to the fact from your statement that the United States might have been intruding into Nigerian sovereignty in a way, and Nigeria is kind of like playing catch up in terms of just keep face and say, oh, we're doing this together. But there seems to be that there's an aggressive US solo unilateral stuff. How does this speak to the question of sovereignty? How does it speak to the question of other kind of like non-Western military? So I think Nigeria has just signed a military cooperation with Turkey as well. Turkey is having like a military base in Nigeria, and then Russia is on a standby. How does this play to geopolitics, is what I want to say, is the question in terms of the geopolitical competition for power. How does all of this, is Nigeria up for grab?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of layers there, right? I think in terms of to kind of address what I think was your question there about sovereignty or perceptions of sovereignty, one thing I'd say is that sovereignty can be a very powerful political ideal and I think motivating factor of political actors, even when its implementation is quite uneven in practice, right? The Nigerian state does not have de facto sovereignty over parts of Nigeria today, right? Especially in the north, where militants have, essentially taken over. But that does not mean that it is not a powerful kind of political ideal and motivating factor for many Nigerians, both at the elite and the non-elite level. I think particularly with the nature of this US intervention, there's a good degree of polarization, over, around religion and also ethnicity, and that maps on to kind of partisan divides in Nigeria. So this is certainly not to say that there aren't Nigerians who welcome this. I think a lot of them do, but a lot of them don't, and a lot of those who do might also change their minds as depending on how things evolve. I think you're absolutely right to note that suspicion of it's not just the US, it's lots of other Western countries, global countries. You see it too about China, particularly with the role that the Chinese play in a lot of illicit mining in Nigeria. But going back to 2000, 2001, right? Obasanjo, the first post 99 transition civilian ruler of Nigeria, fired his chief of army staff, or retired his chief of army staff, because he was using this American company to essentially advise on restructuring the Nigerian army to make them more professional, because this is following, several decades of military rule, lots of coups. And a lot of military officers really weren't happy that Americans were coming in and telling the president, who was himself a former military man, how to structure the Nigerian military. Likewise, during ECOMOG, I interviewed a lot of Nigerian veterans of the ECOMOG missions in Liberia and Sierra Leone. A lot of them had suspicions that the US was supporting Charles Taylor, all that stuff. And then, I think even last year, before the Trump administration took its current position on Nigeria, the single most important, and I would say, self-destructive statement that an American official made about Nigeria in 2025 was the representative, I believe, from Pennsylvania, who during the hearings on USA or on DOGE claimed that USAID, without providing any
It's
evidence, had
pushing
supported
Boko Haram and stuff, yeah.
exactly the Taliban, ISIS, and Boko Haram. And that barely registered in the US in the news, but I was in Nigeria that whole year essentially. It was massive. I was in Abuja that day, and people are still talking about it to this day. And so there is, that these narrative challenges kind of predate the current, the current approach that the administration is taking. So I think all of that is there. And again, it's not just about the US, it's about many other countries as well. Going back to the history of the Biafran War and stuff, depending on who you talk to, which part of Nigeria, people have different views about which country has been undermining Nigeria, since independence or what have you. But in terms of the kind of the approach that this government is taking, I think it's trying to tread a very delicate line between, you know, cooperating with the Trump administration while kind of trying to make sure that the U.S. focus is on, you know, more of the security issues in the Northeast, you know, in the Lake Chad and you know, the Northwest, but essentially focus more on that kind of the more clear-cut counterterrorism, counterinsurgency stuff against the jihadist groups. And I think that's, you know, the preferred approach of folks in like you in the U.S. military, U.S. AFRICOM, because that's what they've been working on for a while. And I think that politically, it's much more manageable for the Nigerian government to kind of have, you know, be working with the U.S. on that stuff, however, whatever that looks like in practice, than it is to have the U.S. kind of pushing for, you know, to take its own military action in other parts of the country. You know, some of the stuff like in the Middle Belt, I think, is politically much more complicated from Abuja's perspective. So on the one hand, they're trying to kind of manage that relationship with the U.S. very delicately. On the other hand, you know, the Nigerian kind of foreign policy, to the extent I think they've not had much of a strategy in the past, you know, several decades. But it's generally been kind of non-alignment, but more pro-Western non-alignment than anti-Western. You know, like South Africa also says they're non-aligned, and you look at who they're de facto aligning with, it's pretty clear, you know, Iran, Hamas, Russia, China, all that stuff. Nigeria has, I think, kept more in the Western camp while still, you know, I mean, it's maintained diplomatic relations with you know, Iran, Russia, you know, Turkey, China, and then increasingly I think partially just because of you know, genuine interest in some of the military hardware that countries like Turkey can provide, particularly drones and stuff. You know, the Nigerians have been talking to them and looking at that. But I also think there's a political dimension, especially for Tinubu, you know, the issue with this kind of North-South and Muslim-Christian issue. You know, I think that aligning and being very public about his partnerships with countries like Turkey or Pakistan is one way of kind of counterbalancing, you know, the relationship with the U.S., at least. Yeah, in the eyes of Muslim, particularly Muslim northern voters, to say, oh, no, we're not just selling our country to the U.S. We have a military partnership with them to fight Boko Haram and bandits, and we also have a military partnership with these Muslim countries. So I think there's a bit of an angle there. And yeah, where things go from there, you know, who knows?
But James, because of time, let me ask this broad question, but we'll collapse this question, these two questions in one. So the first one is, you mentioned something quite interesting. When you were talking about the Christmas Day attack, and you're talking about Lakurawa, you and I, you've been here, I think last time you came on the podcast, we spoke about Lakurawa. And I didn't remember you describing Lakurawa in the way you've described it today. But you describe Lakurawa as somehow part of maybe ISWAP or Boko Haram, something like a comfort food. If I'm wrong, correct me. So I guess my first question is, Boko Haram and Jaswa have been unable to spread outside of the north to the south, but we're seeing some actions in the southwest that we say is the Fulani. Militants, but a lot of people are also saying it's Boko Haram, is this. So I wanted to differentiate. We've also talked about in our book as well, in the chapter I wrote, you talk about corporations between these organizations. So I wanted to, on the first leg of the question, to distinguish, draw distinction between these groups that are operating this several part of Nigeria, and draw parallels, see where are they the same. Where are they the same? Where are they distinct? And then to conclude, where do you see the Nigerian-US cooperation going in the short term and long term? Where do you see this heading to? So let's conclude on that note.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've made the mistake of asking me about, you know, jihadist expansion and relationship with bandits in the last 5 minutes of this.
But I know
that was very strategic, because I'll have to keep the time, or I'll try. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've written a lot about this regarding Lakurawa. My view has been that it's an umbrella term that captures Sahelian militants broadly. So that's both JNAM and IS Sahel province. Mm-hmm. Though I think it's Sokoto, especially it's mostly IS Sahel. Yeah, I mean, there is expansion of these groups into southwestern Nigeria, and it takes several different forms. It's, you know, for the most part, it's not it's, or I think we can definitely say it's not necessarily kind of contiguous territorial expansion. There's not a kind of land bridge of control from northeastern to southwestern Nigeria where we can say ISWAP controls all this territory, JAS controls all this territory, and you know it stretches across the geopolitical zones. It's more that there have been, and I'll have actually a new study out on this, I think very soon, within a couple of weeks, with some colleagues, you know, about one of these groups that kind of relocated from the northeast to the northwest, north central regions around 2020. And you know, that's actually the group that's kind of been, at least recently, the most destructive out there. It's the JAS cell led by Sadiku, as he's known, the commander. And they've you know, unfortunately, really been on a rampage in 2026, late 2025, early 2026. And you know, there are some other jihadist groups out there as well. And then there are also bandits. The relationships between these jihadist groups and between these bandits and jihadists can fluctuate quite a lot. You know, it kind of goes between true kind of close cooperation, actually conducting operations together, supporting each other, you know, sharing the spoils in terms of any ransoms or looting that they achieve, to kind of more of a deconfliction zone, where essentially the groups are operating in the same general area but have their own camps. They kind of keep their distance and they don't interfere with the other group's operations, provided that the other group doesn't interfere with theirs. And that's kind of in the middle of the spectrum. And then to the other end, you have conflict. And we see conflict. We see conflict between jihadist groups in northwestern and north central Nigeria. We see conflict between jihadists and bandits because they have very different approaches. They have very different ideologies and strategies and grievances, despite, I think, some of the narrative we hear in the U.S. about you know, Fulani Islamization. I think that the Fulani militancy, which and banditry, which is a massive, deadly problem, but I think it has a fundamentally different cause and different trajectory than a genuine jihadist insurgency like Boko Haram and ISWAP. And yeah, and these relationships are never stable. So some, you know, a jihadist group and another jihadist group, or a jihadist group and a bandit group, can cooperate for a bit. And you know, maybe there's a bit of friction and they settle it by moving out and deconflicting, and then they cooperate a bit more and then they clash over some issue. And the bandits in particular are incredibly mercurial. They can be very useful allies for the jihadists because they know the terrain well. Some of these gangs are already quite strong, you know, a lot of fighters, a lot of weapons. They know the local communities one way or another. But they can also be very difficult partners for the jihadists because they can work with them one day and then they have some beef and then next thing you know, they're fighting. So all of that is a short way of saying it's very complicated. And in some ways that friction between groups is one factor that actually, you know, has prevented more of a consolidation by jihadists of kind of Western, North Central, Southwestern, Northwestern Nigeria. But that friction is also not in and of itself enough to stop expansion and to stop violence. And so, you know, Old Oyo National, I did field work in Old Oyo National Park or around Old Oyo National Park last year. At that point, you know, the communities were saying most of their concerns were about bandits coming in from Kwara and Koki. These didn't sound like jihadist groups, although I did learn of one jihadist group, the Mamuda group, that had attempted to, you know, come into the park at one point. And there were some clashes with local vigilantes, but you know this stuff has been happening for several years. It's been clear, you know, warned about it. My colleagues and I warned about it in our last study, and I think unfortunately the recent attack, you know, outside was it the Ogbomosho area, right, Orire, LGA, you know, it's as if anyone needed a reminder. It's a reminder that the government needs to take this very seriously. It's a very sad trajectory. A worrying trajectory, I would say.
So just conclude, where is this U.S. military cooperation going to? Where is it heading to? Where in your estimation, what do you think is... I know you have a kind of like mixed feelings about it, but you know, if you look at it, where do you think it's heading to? Is it going to just fizzle out? Is it going to... What's going to happen? Are we going to see more...
Yeah, there are a lot of ways it could go. I mean, I think there's a direction I think it should go, which is that the U.S. should be very prudent and very discreet, and, you know, should really kind of be attuned to the political challenges and risks within Nigeria. I do think, you know, whatever the you know, my disagreements with the kind of Trump administration's framing of this issue. And I do think that the approach has, you know, it's created a lot of challenges in many ways. But if, you know, if there's a silver lining, if we're to make kind of the most of it, I think it has gotten the Nigerian government's attention. It's put insecurity, you know, it's made that a political issue ahead of the elections, which can be very, you know, that can be bad in some ways because you don't want election insecurity being too politicized. But it also, at least, you know, I think it is forcing the government to take some steps that, you know, things that they even pledged that they would do during the last elections that they just kind of didn't get around to doing, apparently. And it takes, you know, threats from Trump to have them take those moves. So I would say that, you know, I think that, you know, the keeping that focus on some of the, you know, the key commanders, the key nodes between provinces, doing very intelligence-led stuff, kind of trying to keep a very light footprint, letting, you know, insisting that the Nigerians lead, pushing the Nigerians to kind of deliver on their own promises, you know, that would be kind of how I would do it. But, you know, this is, I mean, this is an administration that wants to show that it is being tough and you know, achieving military progress overseas. And I think, you know, I was making this point on social media the other day, but the Nigerian government, the Nigerian military cannot kind of maintain this deniability of what the U.S. is doing because Trump is not going to be covert about this. And so I do have concerns that the U.S. is going to push for more big operations because they look good, whatever the tactical impact, and regardless of the political consequences. I think the Nigerians are, you know, I don't think their messaging, at least the military's messaging now, accounts for that. I don't think it accounts for the fact that Nigerians are already well aware that there are U.S. troops operating on Nigerian soil now. And in terms of, yeah, in terms of how kind of does it escalate, does it increase, does it decrease, you know, we're talking well outside my area of focus now. That also depends on how things go with Iran, Ukraine, Venezuela, Cuba as of this week, right? There's a lot of other stuff happening in the world. So, and it might not be a clear cut, oh, the U.S. draws down or the U.S. ramps up. It could be we don't hear anything for a while, and then in 6 months or a year, there's a big, you know, Tomahawk missile strike, or there's some big raid, you know, and all of a sudden AFRICOM is announcing a bunch of operations in Nigeria. So yeah, that's it's not a very clear answer.
No, it is. I agree with you 100%.
And be cautious. But, yeah.
And you know, we've always, you and I, when we talk this kind of conversation, we never can be able to have this conversation in one, in a single podcast. We need to have a series of podcasts. I think we need to kind of like map out a series of podcasts and just have a special series to just tackle this thing. But I do agree with you. Nigeria being Nigeria, and it's kind of like big broad Africa kind of mentality. Nigeria is not one that wants to be seen as you know, playing submissive or say in his own, especially in his own turf, his own territory. So I agree with you on that perception. But anyways, we're out of time. And then James, I'm really grateful and appreciative of your time and of your insight. And I'll keep in touch and hopefully they will listen to your advice, but you know, we'll see. All right. Have a great day there, James, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Thank you very much for tuning in today. Let me, as usual, thank my friend, colleague, and a regular guest, James Barnett, for his wonderful assessment of the U.S.-Nigeria security, recent security cooperation. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you shortly.